Welcome back, Sports Medicine Broadcast at the Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Day. It's a great opportunity for us to get content, speak with great presenters. We have Dr. William Mosey. He is, I was just talking to him that I've seen him talk several times on PRP, but now he's talking about spinal injuries and athletes. So it's something that I'm always a little scared of is back stuff, because there's so much involved in evaluating the back. Mm-hmm. So this is an interview actually I'm really interested in sitting in on and listening to you talk a little bit more about, because there's so many times, like last time I heard a presentation about the spine, someone was saying, you know, if a kid that's, you know, 16 has persistent back pain for, you know, a few months, and we need to send them for an x-ray to make sure that there's not a spondylolysis.
Sure.
I always get those two confused. Sure. Pieces. And so, you know, just to hear a little bit more about that, just in general, your thoughts and kind of how things are moving forward. Of course, we have Dr. Josh Yellen, representing the University of Houston Masters of Athletic Training, and Daniel Young, representing Katie Taylor High School, and Jasmine, again, representing the future of University of Houston Masters of Athletic Training. So Jasmine is a great help to me, and I'm very thankful that she's here today helping me out. All right, so Dr. Mosey, give us a brief overview of the presentation, and then we'll go from there.
Great. Well, thank you for having me. So my topic was looking at spine injuries in sports, and this is actually part of a bigger mini symposium within the conference. So right now, even as we speak, Brian Duncan, one of the physical therapists, is talking about spine rehab. And the reason why Brian and I kind of tag team together talking about spine injuries is for this that particular reason. Like, as you mentioned before, you know, some people feel uncomfortable with managing the spine. So it's a very kind of scary structure. So we're trying to demystify certain things, and just there are a lot of things that athletic trainers can do in the training room for evaluation and even treatment, which can help keep the athlete on the field. So that's one of the purpose. So my portion of it was talking about more of the medical aspects of it. You know, the different injuries that you see, how to diagnose it, treatment of the injury, and then Brian's talking about the, you know, rehabilitation aspect of things, because physical therapy is an integral portion for any sort of a spine injury. And then later on in the breakout session, I'll speak about the physical exam, how I approach an athlete who comes to my office with spine injuries, and Brian's going to go through the basics of rehabilitation. So the hope is that everyone in the conference will get a better grasp of how to manage spine injuries.
So if I could tell you, right, Brian Duncan is incredibly qualified. He's actually adjunct faculty for me, and he's teaching that spine class.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he just validated all of my thought processes. I want to go back just a little bit and talk about your qualifications. You know, you are a physiatrist.
Right.
Right. So you went through, obviously, medical school, and then you did your residency in physical medicine and rehabilitation. And, this makes you uniquely qualified to diagnose and treat non-operative, cases of the back and spine. So can you talk a little bit about that training
Sure.
that you went through and,
Sure.
and how... You know, if you talk about a sports medicine team, you know, it's so important that we have a physiatrist on with us.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, certainly. So, yeah, my background is physical medicine rehabilitation, otherwise known as physiatry. And I did my training at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. And I also did a sports medicine fellowship afterwards with James Andrews and those guys in Birmingham. So what a physiatrist does, one of the big things is really looking at restoration of function after an injury. And physiatry is actually a very big, broad-based field. So my interest is really musculoskeletal injuries, but there are physiatrists who focus on cancer rehabilitation, stroke rehabilitation, brain injury, spinal cord injury, amputation, and whatnot. In fact, another physiatrist in my department, she actually heads up TEER's amputation department. So there's, you know, especially with the wounded warriors coming in, I mean, she keeps her very, very busy. So my focus really is looking at, musculoskeletal injuries, and one of those injuries is spine. So how physiatrists end up getting into spine probably came through just with a lot of, you know, spinal cord injuries and things of that nature, but a lot of what we do, I don't really do spinal cord injury as much. A lot of what we do is look at, like, the non-operative, non-surgical ways to treat common low back injuries and neck injuries as well. So disc injuries, muscle strains, spondylolysis, facet problems, and the such. One of the integral part is to really look at the athlete as a whole. That's one of the big things. One of the big things I'll kind of emphasize when I do my breakout session for the physical exam is you really want to observe observe the athlete as a whole. And there's some of the, a lot of times with the back injuries, for instance, there's something that they're doing to bring this injury on. There's something going on, some underlying issue that needs to be addressed that that hasn't really been looked at closely, either a muscle imbalance or if it's a pediatric athlete, you know, they're going through growth spurts, so they may have asymmetries. Do they have underlying scoliosis that hasn't been diagnosed? Do they have muscle imbalance? This is core weakness, hamstring tightness, hip flexor weakness or hip flexor tightness that hasn't been addressed. So, you know, with my training, we were taught to kind of look at all of those things, you know, comprehensively and then develop a really good non-surgical treatment plan. We work pretty closely with the surgeons, however, because not all spine can be treated non-surgically, and you have to have a really good surgeon on board too. So we kind of refer to each other pretty, you know, we work pretty, you know, hand in hand. One other thing I do as a physiatrist that helps with my diagnosis of spine injury is something called EMG nerve conduction studies, electromyography nerve conduction studies. And those are specific nerve tests to look at nerve damage. So we look at where the nerve is damaged, which nerve is damaged, how badly it's damaged, and also potentially how long they've had that damage as well. And that really does help guide my management with these injuries, because if I see a lot of nerve damage on my EMG study, you know, it gives me an idea of how severe this injury is, in addition to the MRI that I might order, or x-ray or CAT scan or whatnot. And then also we'll give the surgeon, if they have to go to surgery, I'll give the surgeon, you know, additional information that'll help them kind of fine-tune where they may want to operate. So that way they're not operating at more than one level needlessly.
So when you're looking at holistic treatment of the patient, you know, athlete, patient, whatever you call it, tell us a kind of step-by-step process that you go through. You know, whenever you're diagnosing a patient, especially with low back issues, whether that be a spondylolysis, spondylolisthesis, et cetera, can you walk us through, and for all the athletic trainers and physical therapists that are listening to this broadcast, can you walk us through a step-by-step process of what you're looking for? And you're going to obviously do this in your breakout session too.
Yeah, the very first thing I look at, actually, the very first thing I come in the room is I look at the patient. So observation is extremely key for looking at the spine, because you want to see how they're walking. Actually, even look at the parent too, because if they have a hereditary issue, you can actually see it in the family. If they might have like a congenital scoliosis or something else going on that's hereditary, you didn't take into account. So I look at the athlete, and that's the very first thing. How are they standing? Are they standing up when they're in the office? Because if they're standing and they can't sit down, they might have a disc injury. Are they lying flat? Are they lying on their stomach? If they're lying on their stomach, once again, you might think they have a disc injury because extension might be alleviating their pain. Are they in tears? Do they look like they're about ready to vomit? I mean, I'm not joking when I say this. That sounds graphic, but sometimes if someone has really acute disc herniation, they're almost in tears. They look sick to their face. You think they're going to pass out because the pain can be very, very severe. So look at things like that. It gives you, really, you know, a lot of cues. Do they have a curvature in the spine? Do they have a scoliosis? Is one shoulder sitting up higher than the other when you first come into the room? You know, little things like that I look for. The next thing, you want to do a very comprehensive history. You want to see how long they've had the injury, how did it occur, where does it hurt the most, you know, does it radiate, what makes it worse, what makes it better, what treatments they've done in the past too. Have they had injections in the past? Have they ever had surgeries in the past? Have you seen a chiropractor in the past? What medications they've been taking? What medications are they taking for other issues? Because that can all play a role in things and back pain as well. Once you get a really good comprehensive history, then you go to the physical exam portion of it. And then once again, physical exam observation is king. So a lot of times I like to have these athletes in shorts. If they don't fight me too much, I'll have them go into the gown, but some people don't like the gown, teenagers. but the key thing is that you really want to do a good assessment of the spine, because you'd be surprised. Sometimes they have what we call congenital or hereditary abnormalities. You actually see it on their skin. You can look for things like hairy patches, which might indicate like what we call a spina bifida for the occulta, where the spinal arches doesn't form. They might have what we call cafe au lait spots, which might mean a bigger neurologic issue called neurofibromatosis. And that's a big issue. Do I see what we call scapular winging? Because sometimes they might have a congenital myopathy on top of this that has not been diagnosed. Do I see like really increased lordosis? So I look at the athlete, you know, very, very closely. I also look for muscle atrophy too. I look at the calf muscles especially. Do I see like one calf larger than the other? Now, it might be due to side-to-side predilection. You know, if you're right-handed, your calf muscles can be a little bit bigger, but I look for little subtle muscle atrophy issues as well. I can keep going if you want me to.
This is great.
So you know, kind of look at, you know, kind of take that into a whole. Also look at, you know, pelvic obliquity. Is one hip kind of sitting higher than the other? Might be due to pain-related issues called myofascial pain, or might be they have a bilabial scoliosis as no one's really taking a look at. So, you know, observation, you know, inspection is really, really key. Then from there, I actually will have them do a gait examination because that tells me a lot right there. So the first thing I have them do is toe walking. So I'll have them kind of walk around their tiptoes.
All that is really, you're just looking.
Just looking at that.
So you haven't even put your hands on, you're just
have not even done that.
The things that you've been trained to do, you just look at all that.
Partly training, partly experience, just learning. because if, when you first start out, sometimes you don't think about these things, and over time you kind of develop and you just see patterns in people and you see things and you see the weird, odd, abnormal cases. And, you know, but yeah, so before I even look at it, I'll look at the parents too. And I'm not lying, because if they have something like hereditary, you can kind of see in the parents sometimes as well. So, you know,
one of the things
that
I always tell, sorry to interrupt there, Dr. Mosey, one of the things I always tell my students is that, you know, to be a good athletic trainer, be a good clinician, you're an anatomical detective. That's what you are. And that before you ever lay your hands on a patient, you need to have a good history and make a good observation and a good inspection, because that physical examination should validate what your original suspicion is. And then I think too many, you know, clinicians, they take a very brief, not a very detailed history, and then they get into their special tests. And once you get into the special tests, well, you know, you could be testing for something. You just have the wrong, you're using that wrong orthopedic test. And so you came up with the wrong diagnosis, which means it's going to be the wrong treatment. And you haven't done anything for that patient.
Well, sorry to interrupt you. From my grad school experience, it was like when I left undergrad, we didn't hit a lot of the spine. And the spine was a little intimidating. So once I was in grad school and learned a lot more tests and learned a lot more specifics, it was take a really good history. Mm-hmm. And everything that you ask, you're kind of narrowing down your point of your point of focus, whether you look at ACL or ankle or back, and whatever testing you use should confirm what your history reveals. Mm-hmm. So instead of having all of these different ACL tests or all of these different ankle tests, if you take a really good history and you can pinpoint what you're going to do, then you can eliminate a lot of testing.
That's exactly right.
And what you're bringing up, Dan, is that, you know, medicine is a game of ruling out, not ruling in. Right. These are all the things that it could be. And now let me start taking all these out. And so, you know, one of the things that I find really interesting about what you're going through is that it's very similar to, you know, an athletic trainer's diagnostic, you know, procedure, you know, what they're going to go through. And that, you know, as a physiatrist, you're really bringing up, you know, a lot of the concepts that you're bringing up fall in line with, you know, osteopathic training. And so a question I have that's kind of off topic, but in your residency program, you know, did you interact a lot with osteopaths? Are you trained to manipulate, you know, all those different things?
So I to answer your first question, yes. So in my residency class, there are 3 MDs and 3 osteopaths, which was fantastic because they bring a different viewpoint to medicine that I didn't appreciate going through your traditional allopathic training. Yeah, I'm a big fan of osteopaths because they have the standard medical background that we have. Plus, they have a different skill set with doing manipulation. Now, you really need to do it consistently and be very well trained in it. So I have not been trained in manipulation. I have an appreciation for it, but I generally defer that to people who have a lot of experience, because manipulation is great if you do it properly, but I've seen cases where if you do it improperly, it makes things worse instead of better. That's with any treatment in medicine. So I'm a big believer in osteopathy, and I really value my osteopathic colleagues and think very highly of them. So, yeah, I was exposed to it quite a bit, and actually even during residency, for one of our lectures, kind of a little off topic, we actually did have like an osteopath lecture where they kind of showed us some basic, you know, kind of basic manipulation skills and things. Once again, I do not do that in my regular practice. I would not suggest it. It's not, you don't do a weekend course. It's something you really want to be trained year in and year out with someone who's really expert at doing it, and you really want to be well trained in it, because you can cause harm if you do the wrong thing.
You know, it's one of those things of, so again, you know, you brought up, Dan, about the spine. So when we were setting up the curriculum with the, you know, at the University of Houston for the MAT program, the first orthopedic class they have is, you know, they have anatomy first, but then they do lower extremity, then they do upper extremity. And then this summer we have Brian Duncan, and we just do spine, and I'm teaching Brian's lab. And the reason why I'm teaching Brian's lab is that when I was in grad school, I took 6 hours of osteopathic manipulative therapy at the osteopathic school. Mm-hmm. And you're right. If you don't understand the spine, you know, it's kind of like this.
It's crazy.
I don't know how to address it. And, you know, let's refer out. And so I think what people need to understand is there are certain concepts, in my opinion, correct me if I'm wrong, about the spine, right? The first is this theory of like ontogeny, recapitulating phylogeny, right? Like we are quadrupedal mammals, and at some point we become bipedal mammals. And if you understand all those biomechanical insufficiencies, then you can start to break apart, you know, these different segments of the spine and understand that each vertebra has its own biomechanical forces and that everything is working holistically. And that if I have an issue in the cervical spine, then I'm going to have, you know, I may have an issue in the lumbar spine.
Potentially.
So tell me, or tell everybody.
Can we go back? Mm-hmm. I interrupted your original. You were walking through the.
You're about to go through a gate.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Go back to your. Sorry. Go back to your.
Let's go to that, and then we can go to all this other stuff.
So actually, you know, one thing you brought up too, but ACL injuries. So one thing also I've been looking into, or actually taking note of. I also look at other musculoskeletal injuries too. If they had ACL tears, hip surgeries, if they even shoulder surgeries, you'd be surprised because that kind of key, especially like a basal player, a lot of shoulder surgeries. Now he's having back pain. Okay, what's going on with his throwing mechanics? We got to talk about that because you know. That's kind of showing a pattern. Or like a golfer who has like, you know, persistent shoulder, elbow, wrist, back injuries. There's something going on. They have to once again address those underlying causes. So I do look at that as well. So even with ACL, if they have back issues and ACL issues, core stabilization, they have core hip weakness. Is something with their neuromuscular patterns, like if they're basketball athletes, for instance, they would have to address. So once again, kind of keeping that in mind, I have to put it all together. They aren't very rarely are these injuries separate. Now, you know, now just my thinking, I realize they're very rarely are these injuries separate. You got to take all that into account. So, but now going back to my physical exam, so we got to gait. So gait, we do toe walking, and toe walking is really good for, you know, especially if I think someone has an S1 nerve root problem, because you use a gastrocnemius muscle, it's S1 innervated muscle. So I look at that. Plus, I like that because then I can look at calf atrophy, presence or absence of calf atrophy or muscle atrophy. And then, two, I can kind of see if they're kind of becoming more lordotic, how their hips are moving. Then I do heel walking, which really, you know, which is very difficult, actually, even if you don't have a back problem, because you have, you know, it's a balance issue sometimes in addition to a strength issue. But with heel walking, you're kind of firing that tibialis anterior muscle especially, which is an L5 innervated muscle. So if you worry about someone possibly having a foot drop, you know, they'll have difficulty heel walking on the side where they might have the foot drop. One thing I've also been doing in addition, because some people can actually compensate. Some people have enough that they can compensate. And it might fool you into thinking that, okay, they don't have something. So I actually do great toe walking, which is kind of weird. But what I have them do is actually have them, if they can do it, providing they don't have like bunions or anything else, actually have them kind of walk with their big toe, with their toes up, and see if they can actually do that and see if they can actually hold their toes up, because extensor hallucis longus, that muscle is very sensitive when you have L5 radiculopathy, even more so than ankle dorsiflexion. Like great toe extension, you lose that pretty quickly. So that's one thing I've kind of started doing too. It's not written in any book, I just kind of started doing
it. It's one of those things that you said, you know, over time, that's what you're
doing. You just pick it up, yeah,
with everything. Jeremy's actually trying it in the background.
Yeah, he's doing it right now.
It's kind of difficult to do. You want to try to keep their feet as flat as possible, try to get them to see if they can actually do it. But once again, you have the confounding factors. If they have, like, you know, great toe arthritis, turf toe, you know, if they have bunions or other, you know, toe issues at that first MDP joint, it might be difficult just in general. But we can at least attempt it. Then I do tandem gait. Because one thing with tandem, you know, you want to do a tandem gait because – one thing with the tandem gait is that you ever want to make sure that you miss like a lesion higher up. So you might be thinking it's radiculopathy, which is kind of a lower motor neuron lesion. They could have like a spinal cord syrinx, or, you know, God forbid, something going on in the neck or the brain that you haven't taken into account. So with that toe walking, you're really doing more of a balance assessment, among other things. So that's gait. Then I go to range of motion. So I basically just see how they do with bending forward and bending backwards and see how far they can go. And then, you know, how much of it's going to be pain limited to. I even do that before I do palpation, actually, because if you start pressing on someone, they start to get a lot of pain from that. You might automatically start affecting some of your other tests. So try to get the ones out of the way that aren't going to affect things too much. So forward flexion, lumbar extension. With the way I do my lumbar extension specifically is to try to eliminate as much of the thoracic spine as possible. So I had them kind of do the, I call it the IG Imagini, which I learned from one of my attendings in Atlanta. I didn't come up with this myself, Ruben Sloan. So it was from Ruben Sloan. But basically put your hands together like this and you bend backwards. That way you kind of try to eliminate.
While they're standing or sitting?
Standing, and bend backwards. You kind of try to eliminate sort of potential torsion of the thoracic spine, theoretically, just kind of stabilize a little bit more. So forward flexion is important. So forward flexion, they have a lot of pain there. You can think possible disc injury. That's one of the big things you think of. You can also think like myofascial pain as well. Lumbar extension, you have to think more facet and more spondylolysis. So those are two big things, especially in the population you guys see, like kind of more, you know, kids 22, 21 and younger. You know, you're going to see, you know, that's what you have to think. Now, that being said, you can have, of course, it's not set in stone. Nothing is ever set in stone. And you can have, especially disc injuries, depending on how the herniation is, sometimes the extension makes it worse. The other thing I'll do, too, with lumbar extension, I'll do what we call facet loading, which is basically extension with axial rotation. What I'm trying to do is either irritate the facet joint, or sometimes I'll even try to irritate that nerve foramen. So if they have a very far lateral herniation, you can kind of try to hit that nerve root and see if you can kind of go down and get it to reproduce some of the leg symptoms. Same thing with forward flexion, too. You want to see if they complain like leg pain, you want to see if it reproduces, bending forward reproduces the leg pain, because you can think more possible radiculopathy. So I've done, and also the other thing, too, when you bend forward, you know, do Adams forward bending test, make sure, look at your side profile, make sure they don't have like a horrible kyphosis. Mm-hmm. If you think about that, then you can do things, look for Sherman's disease called the Schober test, which is kind of a little bit further than I wanted to. But you can do things like that to kind of see if there's any translation or movement of those thoracic segments as well.
Can you go back to Sherman's disease? Is there a population that you see that more in, like women's gymnastics?
Can you describe what it is?
Yeah, so the thoracic, I didn't talk about it in my presentation this because I really wanted to go, this is more congenital, but it's a thoracic kyphoscoliosis. It's congenital. Tend to see it. So I don't actually really I have not seen a lot of it. the rare cases I've seen were actually adult patients who they were like, you know, in their 60s and they just kind of long term, hunched over. But you can see it. As all of our postures are completely horrible. you have a good posture. I'm leaning forward like this. With Sherman's disease, though, a lot of times it will affect your thoracic segments. It can be very, very painful. It's kind of a thoracic kyphoscoliosis. So male more than female, though it depends on population. And it can sometimes depend on, like, which region of the country, too. A lot of times it's a diagnosis also. So you can diagnose it, you know, by clinical exam. You see really, you know, significant scoliosis, you know, significant kyphosis. Plus, if you haven't been forward, if you're not seeing a lot of translation or movement of those kind of thoracic segments, then you actually can kind of mark on the skin, see how much movement you get. It's called the Schober test. Mm-hmm. If you see that, you know, the gamma indicated. Then, of course, on imaging, particularly, especially on MRI, you can see things called Schmorl's nodes, which are kind of little cystic areas. Is like kind of within the vertebral bodies, which are kind of pathognomonic for Sherman's. Now, you see more Sherman's disease. You can see Schmorl's nose anywhere, but you tend to see a lot in Sherman's disease as well. I got to be honest with you, I don't know. I haven't seen a lot. In either the pediatric ortho guys see more of it than I, or they kind of are make you see those patients. I haven't seen a huge amount of it in my practice. I guess how it's happened. It's not necessarily, I haven't seen a lot of it. I see scoliosis more than I see Sherman's disease, definitely.
And so for those athletic trainers that are just, you know, coming out of school, getting into practice, for those athletic trainers that have been in practice for a while, what are some key points that you want us to know? You know, obviously there's a relationship that we would form with our physician. Mm-hmm. And obviously in this case, you know, physiatrist with sports medicine fellowship, perfect combination. And so give us some of the things, you know, Dan is in clinic, he sees an athlete with some back issues. Can you walk through and kind of guide us to what would constitute a referral to you? What would be a conversation over the phone?
Yeah, great question. So you should always be aware of your red flags, you know, I like to call them. You know, if you have an athlete coming in with, you know, severe pain, you know, pain is really out of, you know, if you know the kid pretty well, like, well, they're really a lot of pain for someone, you know, that particular kid. If they also have, you know, neurologic compromise, weakness, severe numbness, paresthesias, you know, that's a big issue. Of course, bowel and bladder problems, that's a big issue too. Those are emergencies. In fact, you may even want to you can make the argument you can bypass me and send them to the emergency room, because this is probably, you know, if they start getting really significant, like, you know, urinary retention or bowel issues, you know, that's a big problem. Also, say like in football, say if it's like football practice, a kid, you know, gets hit really badly, complains a lot of back pain, you palpate the spine, you notice a lot of spinous process tenderness. You know, it's probably a good idea, you know, if you have pretty heavy amount of spinous process tenderness, it's really not going away over time, you probably want to at least get an x-ray, make sure they didn't have like some sort of, you know, fracture or anything like that. Now it's tough because they may not have anything, but that's when you start to think about, oh, do I need to kind of send someone in, especially if they're having pretty severe pain. But the big thing really is that neurologic compromise. And of course, you know, the lesser issues, you know, fever, chill, night sweat, especially in a pediatric, you know, younger population, you really shouldn't have that. Any population shouldn't have that with low back pain. You know, that might indicate something more serious like infection or something even worse than that. So, you know, that's when you want to send them in. Now, it's interesting. So how long, so say a kid doesn't have these things, but still has persistent low back pain, how long could you wait before you send them in? So, you know, you can really think about severity of the pain, and then also like duration. I'll probably, you know, if after like 3 or 4 weeks they're still having some issues, probably want to get them in. You know, typically, so if you look at low back pain overall, so just a general population, within 6 weeks they all get better for most people, like, you know, most of the time. So it's those people that doesn't get better after that 6 week period. You're worried about. But, you know, if the kid still has kind of persistency, axillary back pain, like, you know, non-radiating, but kind of still persistently there, the point is limiting his ability to participate in a sport, is, you know, been like, you know, 2-3 weeks now, I mean, I'd be more than happy to see them, because you want to try and address the issue. And if you can catch him sooner rather than later, that'd be, you know, that's ideal. You know, your ultimate goal is to make sure these, you know, the athletes stay on the field and this doesn't become too big of an issue.
All right, so let me jump in here for a second. I just brought in Brian Duncan. So, Brian, there's the camera there. And then when you talk, I'm talking to the microphone. And I brought him in because he was part of your presentation.
Yes.
And so that way you guys can kind of work together. And then Ryan Collins is joining us. He's going to be taking my seat, so throwing some other questions out there for you guys. So, Brian, feel free to jump in at any time. Comments out there. Dr. Mosey, ask questions of him. Y'all work together. Y'all just
have an A-team here now. And this is a it's a great symposium. Now. This is fantastic.
All right, so things that I noticed in volleyball, mm-hmm. like volleyball was on your list of most commonly associated back injuries.
Actually, I should put that on there. Could put that on there, yeah.
But we found mostly in our off-season program, we had a slew of kids, a slew of girls come in with low back pain, mm-hmm. No shoulder-related issues, mm-hmm. no disc issues, no general radiating pain. Mm-hmm. And initially it was, well, let's just look at your low back, you know, no facet issues, no muscle issues. Hmm. And then we branched out a little bit and said, well, let's look at your posture. Mm-hmm. And all of our kids have bad posture.
Yes.
And let's look at your hip flexor and general tightness.
Yeah.
And we ended up testing, my volleyball coach was very cool about it. Yeah. We ended up testing, I ended up testing everybody's posture, mm-hmm. and everybody's hip flexor, just general flexibility. Mm-hmm. Every girl had bad posture, mm-hmm. And more than half had really poor hip flexor flexibility. Mm-hmm. And we changed their off-season program a little bit. Mm-hmm. And for those three and everybody else that hadn't come in, I didn't get any revisits. Yeah. So we had like general flexibility program, general posture program.
I think you bring up a really good point.
Fantastic.
You can look at your athletes and start to see what their postures are and kind of what issues they might be mm-hmm. more at risk from, or if we think about volleyball, the impact of their squat form is going to end up having on their back. You know, what their hips do is going to influence their spine as well as their knees. And I think by addressing, you know, posture and flexibility, I think that's a that's an excellent start and a wise way to go about it.
Well, yeah. If you look at freshman volleyball players are awesome. Not at playing, but they're great for figuring out trouble with because none of them hit a ball right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Volleyball, you're supposed to hit fairly straight back versus like tennis, you really overarch
the torch. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So besides just biomechanics training, you can only train somebody so much in posture. Mm-hmm. You can only get them to change their forms so much. Is there a good way besides just basic stand on a wall, kind of sit against the wall to work on their posture? Or is there a way to change their overall biomechanics?
I mean, I'll let you guys definitely jump in on this one because, I mean, you definitely hit a really big, important thing. You know, kind of what I mentioned before, the athlete's doing something to bring their back pain on. You have to figure out what it is. And that's actually your example is really, really a great example of, you know, you do a lot of the imaging. You do all the imaging and everything. You just don't really see anything on the imaging. And you may not even need to with that population. But you're right. I mean, you know, hip flexor tightness, you know, gluteal weakness, hamstring flexibilities, I mean, core instability or not having like core strength, especially in those kind of, the volleyball players themselves, they're kind of a tall, lanky, kind of sometimes,
goofy looking,
awkward athletes just in general, both male and female, I'm picking on. They're great for volleyball. You want the height, but, you know, they're still developing, and they still have so many muscle imbalances. And then you have to think, like, you know, what's their torso length compared to their kind of hip and leg length and things of that nature. All that's going to play a role in their having their back issues. So now you have people who really, at baseline, don't have a lot of great core strength, don't have a lot of great flexibility, and then you're having them trying to spike a volleyball, jump up really high, block a volleyball, do that repetitively, going up and down. Then you have like the landing motion, and Brian's weightlifting course, he showed a great, great picture of a football player doing the broad jump. You think this football player, he'd be like, he'd be perfect. And the guy had the jumping. It looked like a 14-year-old girl when he was jumping. I'm not gonna say who it is because he's listening. I want to punch me in the face. Yeah. But I'm just kidding. He really, just didn't have that very poor mechanics. And I think that really brings to the role this age group, neuromuscular training. And actually, it's interesting, the IOC actually just came up with a consistent statement recently about the importance of neuromuscular training and neuromuscular development in the pediatric and in the younger athlete. But I'll let you guys talk about this some more, definitely.
It's actually, they are in breakout session. They're waiting for you guys.
Oh my gosh.
In this interview, we may be able to pick it back up later after lunch.
Part two. Sure, no problem.